Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello everyone, this is The Ruck from The Times and The Sunday Times. Welcome back, thanks once again for joining us. I'm Alfie Reynolds, and once again, another Monday morning, I am joined in the studio by Elgan Alderman. Elgan, how are you?
Very well, thank you. Had a lovely weekend of rugby and remembrance. I was down at Gloucester for the defeat by Bath on Friday night, and then Saturday, a bit more grassroots at London Welsh versus Brighton for some pre-match singing and take part in the remembrance ceremony as well, which is very poignant by the memorial at the ground where they remembered the club members that lost their lives in the First World War. So I think we saw a lot of those ceremonies at all the games this weekend, very, very well observed, weren't they? It was a very moving weekend.
So I have to ask, when you say pre-match singing, is this part of your choir? Elgan is part of it. Is it a male? Is it a Welsh voice choir?
It's the London Welsh Male Voice Choir. It was a mixture of a few choirs. There's the London Welsh Rugby Club Choir, who often sing down there, and they brought in some reinforcements from the London Welsh Male Voice Choir and from Gwalia, one of the other Welsh choirs in London. So we just did a little bit of singing at the function beforehand, and then a little singing as part of the memorial as well.
One of these days we will get Elgan singing on The Ruck. He has been known to sing on other podcasts. We haven't quite got him singing on The Ruck yet, but at some point we will. Also joining us down the line from our Wiltshire studio, Stuart Barnes. How are you, Barnesy?
I'm all right, and you will not be getting me singing unless I'm inebriated with Bob Dylan. I wouldn't recommend it.
Yeah, well, likewise for me as well. I'll definitely be leaving the singing up to Elgan, I think. Barnsley, we'll get onto it in more detail when we properly get into the Prem, but you were Leicester Quins this weekend, game of the weekend, arguably, I think you'd say.
I don't know. I thought Gloucester Bath was fantastic, but I it was a very good game. Extremely positive at Welford Road. I saw Ian Tempest, the referee, afterwards, and he just said how easy it is for him to referee when you've got two sides who want to play. I think there were a few errors, but overall, it was a fascinating game, very positive and extremely enjoyable.
Well, we'll get on to the Premiership action. Before that, though, piece in the Sunday Times that you had, Stuart, this week. England A games can help unearth the next Martin Johnson. This is in reference to last week. We got the news that England A are back up and running again. They're going to be playing Portugal in February. Roundly speaking, it was something that was met with great regard, I think, amongst the rugby community. I thought it interesting, Stuart, of kind of what you said, the importance of those matches.
Yeah, and I don't think England A playing Portugal on its own is enough. It's a good move, but I just think with this two-month hiatus of Premiership rugby, there's a great opportunity to reinvigorate the A fixtures. And it works very well because of the link between the Six Nations and Rugby Europe. You know, sometimes you just think bottom level of the Six Nations, teams like Italy could do with putting half test teams out against decent Rugby Europe teams. And that would give the stronger team, in theory, a chance to bring through B players. The same applies to Wales, which has a really good team, but not strength in depth. So I think it works at the top level, helping you bring through players, but it also works at the bottom level because, you know, if you look at results, Portugal and Georgia, when they play the likes of Poland and Germany, that's just as lopsided as it has often been when I don't like using the phrase, but what was known as the tier one teams play the weaker tier two teams. So it works for all and sundry. And I think you don't have to have a championship, but there's quite clearly a gap for two weekends of Six Nations against Rugby Europe teams. And I think you could also fill in other fixtures there. And I think that's really important.
It'll be interesting to see, of course, who lines up for England A. I'm sure people will have lots of fun coming up with their own exciting teams of people that they'd like to play. But also, we're not certain of what Portugal team would come out, because they'll have to consider their Rugby Europe Championship campaign as well as the match against England A. Yeah. They may have a game against Ireland. When I spoke to the Portuguese Union president last month about this, he said that they were looking for a game against Ireland's second string team as well as England. At the time of that, yep, I raised the prospect. Now, of course, everyone's trying to figure out how to give teams like Portugal more games, and obviously people are talking about maybe expanding the Six Nations, and currently, just because of time and resources, there's no perfect answer. But I floated the prospect, perhaps, of, in the first instance, having a sort of bridge league between the Six Nations and the Rugby Europe Championship, where you brought back the six A teams and you put them in sort of two conferences of five with Portugal, Georgia, Romania and Spain, perhaps. And you had that as a bridge between the two. So you'd have, as you said, Stuart, you'd have an opportunity for the Six Nations teams to have their second string teams out to have some development, and also potentially give some more forceful games for the likes of Georgia and Portugal to play possibly. Now, I'm sure people will have their thoughts on whether or not that's a good idea or a bad idea, but I just wonder if that's a good stepping stone in between, possibly. And if there are financial concerns among unions in terms of the cost of bringing back A teams, then maybe you sort of merge that with the under-20s, which they already have. As we say, these A teams do often tend to be very developmental anyway, so I don't know if that could play a part in it as well. I don't know what you think about that, Stu.
No, there's no doubt at all. You know, Wolfhounds stroke Saxons stroke Wales B. It's not about the next best 23 on the block. It's about merging players who are in the squad and not getting game time. It's about merging players who are a little bit nearer the test team, but just on the fringe. And it's about playing 18-year-old whiz kids and see if they can fast track. That's very important. What I would say is, immediately we're looking at Portugal and Georgia and their World Cup heroics. But I think if you have two tiers like that, you end up forgetting. And I know there will be a sense, well, who cares? But if the game is going to use that awful phrase that I hate, if it is going to grow, you can't just say to Germany, unlucky, and say to Poland and these teams, they're in that tournament. And I think they've got to stay there. What I would say is, you know, Portugal can play a couple of A games without worrying about Rugby Europe, as long as, you know, there's a couple of weeks, there's 2 weeks where there's no clash. So they can fit in matches there. And I hear people saying, what about health and safety? But this was my point. Portugal and Georgia against, at the moment, Germany and Poland and Belgium should be playing a large number of their players coming through. And that would develop their game. Otherwise, you end up with Georgia. And Romania used to be that in my playing days. They had a really strong team. They only played good teams. When their era of the good teams came to an end, there was nothing left because there'd been no development. So I think it's very important that you don't forget the nations like Belgium and Poland and Germany that we never mention.
And as you said, Stuart, and something you reference in the Sunday Times, is we want to see more of the matches. At the moment, it's just a one-off that they've scheduled for February, isn't there? But as you've gone into, you feel like there's the potential for a schedule to be worked out where we could see more of it. Coming up on today's pod, we're going to look back on the Premiership action. We'll also preview the start of the Women's Premiership season. I spoke with Jess Hayden a little bit earlier, and we're going to name our God or Goddess of the Week. But next up, we'll get into the Premiership review of the weekend. So, Premiership hurtling along at a bit of a rate now, post-World Cup, five rounds down in a shortened season. Where do you both feel we are with the Premiership? I look at some of the results that we've had so far this year, and I've jotted down just a few of them as an example. Gloucester, who we'll get onto because you were at that game, Elgin, they beat Harlequins in week one, but as we might speak about now, they are probably in a position where you're wondering where the progress is. Bristol, who are in a similar position to Gloucester, having lost three of their five games, they beat Northampton in week two. We've seen Leicester beat Bath, and Leicester seem to be struggling at the moment as well. Exeter beat Sale 43-0 in week three. And then we saw Northampton put in a great performance and beat Exeter over this weekend. So, yeah, it's kind of funny, isn't it? You start to feel like Sale and Harlequins look like they're going to be there. Saracens, now that they're bringing their World Cup stars back and having lost their opening games, seem to be building again. But there's a lot of sides, once again, underneath those teams that you feel on any given weekend anyone could beat anyone.
And we're still coming, getting a full picture of what the teams look like. We're only, obviously, we had three rounds during the World Cup, and now we've had two now since some of the world players have been World Cup players rather have been coming back in, and most of them are back now. So you see teams like Bath, who had lost two of their four games, but only lost two of them by a combined margin of 7 points, and then they've won three other games with bonus points. So yes, they're looking good. Harlequins, back to perhaps their form of a few years ago when they thrilled everyone. You'd assume that Leicester would be able to turn this around, lying ninth at the moment, having won only one of their first five games. So I think we still are developing a picture of just who is doing what. But equally, if we have an entire season of everyone beating everyone, then that can only be exciting. So we'll see how it goes.
Exciting, but also very transitional. And this is where you get back to that point Eddie Jones used to make. Club rugby, the step up is huge. It's what I've just been talking about with the difference in preparation, select teams as opposed to your club teams. And I think what we're seeing at the moment, and I thought we saw it last year and to an extent the year before, is the Premiership actually thinking that it does need to draw new fans. I think there's a willingness for most of the teams to play more attacking rugby. What we saw from Northampton is what we've always seen from Northampton, but Bath with Russell are changed. Gloucester are interesting because they're trying to change, and then when things start to go wrong, they really don't understand how to press the button. But that's what happens when you have transitional rugby. We're going from quite dour English club rugby for a long period to very exciting club rugby, and the victim is quality, and that's why, you know, everyone talks about the wage cap. And of course the wage cap gives French clubs and the Irish provinces an advantage, but there's more to it than that. There's this limbo in which we are at the moment, and it's an exciting limbo, and I think it's very important that you've got to accept that there will be games where defences look terrible. Gloucester have got, for example, have got to keep their nerve and they've got to keep playing. I really do believe that. I don't think the game can be sustained when you've got 10 teams and just saying, we don't care how we play as long as we win. It's not enough teams. It becomes boring. The rugby has to be exciting. And then the international coaches have got to find this way to merge what is happening at club rugby, which is not international rugby, with the test match game.
It was something Jack Clement, the Gloucester back rower, said to me last week. I'd asked him what his view was of the World Cup, watching as a player with England ambitions, playing in the Premiership Rugby Cup, in the Premiership, watching the World Cup, and his main takeaway was just how there were different styles on show. You had South Africa with their sort of traditional forward power bomb squad, but equally with a little bit of excitement. Then you had New Zealand throwing it about a bit more. England very much sort of pragmatism and kick first. And he said that he enjoyed that because he hopes that the Premiership can have 10 teams playing in 10 different ways, and you don't want everyone playing the same. So even among players, that, you know, it's something that they hope will come out of the season as well.
Well, should we focus on the Gloucester-Bath game a little bit more then? It's going to be the manner, the way that game changed is what concerns Gloucester, isn't it? 35 points conceded in that second half.
The first half, Gloucester were superb. Santi Carreras, who was back playing at fullback where he does for Gloucester, he plays at fly half for Argentina, but watching objectively, I think you can say that he definitely plays his best rugby at fullback. He had a hand in just about everything brilliant that Gloucester did. They were running brilliant, crisp backline angles. You had Johnny May having a great time out wide, Ollie Thorley as well, Santi Carreras already mentioned. To go 20-10 up, they looked brilliant. They looked set for a bonus point win in that game. And then suddenly, yes, to lose 35-7 in the second half, conceding 28 unanswered points. And after the match, George Skivington seemed, you know, he was white as a ghost. He didn't quite know what had gone wrong. He didn't really know what to say. He was just completely nonplussed about how they had just completely fallen away from dominating the fixture to not getting any points out of it.
And Barnsley, do you feel that, going back to something you said just now, that Gloucester need to hold their nerve with how they're almost trying to change their game plan? Is this almost just a product of a team who were very good at one thing when we saw them have a decent season where they finished fifth and they had that driving maul which no one could stop? They're looking to now be a little bit more of an all-round team, but sometimes when you try and do that, things go wrong, they don't always click. Would that be your explanation, or do you think Gloucester fans would be right in feeling a little bit more concerned from what they saw from their team?
I wouldn't be concerned about the way they play or the season in general. I would be slightly concerned. I think George Skivington's essence is of a tight driving forward. I think he wants the team to play as his position dictated in the second row. I know he played for a Wasps team that played some good rugby, but his default position has been, since he's been DOR of Gloucester, to tighten it up. It's what he likes to do. He likes the box kicks. He likes a driving more. And I just think he's in alien territory at the moment. And it's very interesting what Elgin's saying as well about Carreras, because last year, I was adamant, and I still am, by the way, that Carreras has to play fly half there, because he's so much more creative than any other option they've got. And he probably is a better fullback there. But if you play him fly half, when everything is going well, it gives them a back three, for example, of May, Thorley and Louis Rhys-Zammit. They can't afford not to play one of those players. And if they've got all of those players on the pitch and they're functioning, then they're going to score a lot of tries. And Carreras, I don't think he had a great World Cup as a fly half, but at the Premiership level, he could still be an outstanding player. You know, what do Gloucester do now? I suspect they'll tighten up a little bit in the next game. And I don't think they should. I think they should keep playing. I think the most important thing at the moment in Premiership rugby is how they play, not the final result. Now, it's very easy for me as a journalist to say that, and it's not easy for a coach to say that. But I think, you know, coaches would find willing ears if they're talking to their owners and saying, we need to be part of something that is really elevated, that is really lifted from where it's been for a long time. Because like I said, I think a 10-team league with the same old faces is going to bore everyone rigid unless something changes. And I do see change at the moment.
And also, what won't bore people rigid at the moment is Finn Russell. We can't mention this game without mentioning him. Elgin shushing the shed already has got himself into the hearts of the Bath fans. You feel, don't you, that, I know we're only 5 games into the season and he was at the World Cup for a bit, but he came straight back in to play for Bath, that you can kind of see the Finn Russell personality on this Bath team a little bit in terms of how they're playing?
Absolutely. That's the type of incident that, you know, it goes around social media. It gets eyeballs on something that happened in the league, not necessarily one of his cute inside passes. And the irony of that game was that Bath's best player was in the second half, but the two bits of play I remember most from Finn Russell in that game were his two cute inside passes to Max Ajomo, which eventually led to points in the first half. And I'm sure Stuart loved seeing those, that taking it to the line and giving it late to runners on either side of you. Certainly, it was an excellent early start to that partnership with Ajomo and Ollie Lawrence, both of whom showed up very well with Finn inside them. You know, he's got two big ball carriers outside him that can offer him that power with his box of tricks. So certainly the early signs are very good. I'm sure Stuart was enjoying seeing a Bath fly half play like that.
Yeah, taking the ball to the line is something that so few teams do, and defences can get a grip because they're in control, because they're watching what the playmaker is doing, and then they can react. With Finn Russell, he gets right up there and he reacts at the last minute. And I said today, that's one of the reasons why. He's not the biggest bloke and he's not the most powerful, but even when he's looking to offload, people can't stop him because he gets defenders in not quite the A position and he's able to get that ball away. And that's linked to his capacity to turn it in or to turn it out, because he's only got a millisecond in which to make that decision. Defences have even less time. I have argued about this game. Defence coaches have been dominant and they have controlled the clock. They have been the people who have been saying, we'll force attackers to play under our terms. Finn Russell can turn that around. That's why he's such an exciting player. And that's why there are errors as well. But you've got to live with that because the positives outweigh the negatives. The other thing I think that's very important is a professional game. It is about, you know, I'm not a great man for the online, but it's an important way of trying to develop and bring new support in. And Russell does. Russell is not just a player for Bath. Bath have signed a commodity, and that shush in the shed instance when he got 1.3 million viewers just on Premiership Rugby online alone just tells you about the capacity he's got to lighten the load and also to really inspire Bath supporters and rugby fans in general. But Finn Russell, he's doing what he loves to do, which is be a great rugby player and to attract spectators. So, you know, I think he's one of the best signings there has been at club rugby in the history of the Premiership.
And we'd better move on to some of the other games, but just finally then on Bath, you talk about the Finn Russell signing, Barnsley. Do you feel, is he the kind of signing that can get this Bath team playing to their potential? And because we've always looked at Bath, haven't we? And like on paper, they've always been a squad and some of the names they could field that you expected more from, and they've never been able to deliver. Is it too much to put it on Finn's shoulders that all of a sudden that will change? Or, I don't know, just that force of personality, the fact that everyone else around him maybe is relaxing because of the style of his play, could be something that gets more out of this Bath team?
I think with Johan van Graam, a fairly staid South African forwards coach, being in charge, Bath needed a bridge between that mentality and what Russell gives them. Now, it might be in some games they need to rein it in, but he's got a wondrous kicking game as well, and he can do that. But I think at the moment, Russell has just pressed the go button. It doesn't matter who you've got in terms of personnel. If you're playing rugby by numbers, as Bath have largely done under Stuart Hooper and in the early years of van Graam, if individuals won't take responsibilities and are afraid to take risks because it goes outside the system, then you end up with not a pragmatic form of rugby, but a dull and losing form of rugby. And, you know, what Bath were doing is what England have been doing. And that's why it's very important to have a catalyst. And I think that's the word for Russell. He's a catalyst, but his personality is such, he'll drag the younger players with him and say, come on, we can have a go.
And actually, we mentioned Finn Russell. I thought one of the storylines of the weekend in the Premiership was fly halves generally, because you had both Alex Sanderson and Pat Lamb praising George Ford for the way he marshalled Sale around the park at Ashton Gate, and Sale winning 27-13 against Bristol. And then the Sunday game, Finn Smith, man of the match, Northampton 34, Exeter 19, young guy who was good from the tee, put a lovely little kick in for Tommy Freeman for the first try. You as well, I suppose, Stuart, were at Leicester Harlequins, where you had Marcus Smith, Andre Pollard, that sort of matchup. I felt like it was a weekend for tens, really.
Good weekend for tens. George Ford will never play like Finn Russell, but I think if you want to write a manual of how to play constructive fly half play, his drop goal and his flat pass for Sam James, that's how you marshal a game. That was Ford far more positive than he became with England in the World Cup. Smith was very good, and so was Pollard. Very contrasting fly halves. Smith is the will of the wisp. Pollard is a strong carrier with a poetic pass. He's a beautiful passer of the ball. And Finn Smith was very good. But can I also mention one other non-fly half?
Yeah.
And it's interesting. I thought Alex Mitchell played really well, and I've given Borthwick and the English management a bit of a booting, but I think their attempt to just slow him down and make him a little bit more conservative, to box a little bit more than he did, actually worked. I thought the balance of the Northampton game with Mitchell running the show from nine was better. We still had those Mitchell breaks, but we had not more kicks, but better kicks. And I thought that made Northampton look like a team who, you know, we always say, oh, on their day, they can beat anyone, but they can't because their pack hasn't been good enough. But there's a structure to their game now, and there's a pace as well. And Mitchell's right in the middle of the sandwich, and I think he's turning them into a team of contenders. And I would give the England management some credit for saying, you know, I've said before, you don't want everyone going 150 miles an hour, and you don't want people playing at 1 mile an hour. You've got to find that in-between ground. And I thought Mitchell was exploring the in-between very well.
You mentioned George Ford there, Stuart. He does seem to be launching a one-man campaign to bring the drop goal back, something that you knew all about back in your day when it was a bit more of a common tactic. Is it something you'd like to see more of, or are teams aware that it is quite a high-risk strategy because it doesn't always pay off because it is such a difficult skill?
Oh, Elgin, I don't think it's a high-risk strategy at all. I cannot see how on pitches where it's not the mud of the old days, a drop goal worth 60% of a try is anything but a sensible thing. It puts different sorts of pressures on defence. I'm a great believer, you score tries, but when you get penalties, if they're kickable, you build and you accumulate. And Ford is doing that. And that's right. I don't want to see more drop goals because I think drop goals should be worth fewer points. But while there were 3 points, then any fly half worth his salt will be taking the opportunity to go build a score.
And just to stick on the Northampton Exeter game for a second, something we mentioned last week actually, Elgin, but you do feel that Northampton, a big focus for them this year, and one of the big positives I think from what we've seen so far this season has been their defence and a bit more forward grunt. As you say, Stuart, we've always known that they've been a team that can score tries. They've lost in Premiership semi-finals because they've lost up front. I think that seems to me to be a real focus of them this year. I also wanted to mention the Niall Armstrong red card for Exeter fairly late on in the game. Northampton were leading 27-12 at the time, so it didn't have a huge impact, I think, or an impact at all on the result. But for those that didn't see it, he went up to catch a high ball. He's come back down, and the officials have deemed that he was in control. It wasn't a natural action to put his boot up, which then caught the face of Finn Smith. His studs caught him, saying it's reckless and therefore it's a red card. Stuart Hogg, interestingly, on commentary, as a former fullback, saying he felt that it was pretty harsh and a natural thing to do.
When I was watching it, I agreed with Stuart Hogg. I didn't think it was as black and white to say that Armstrong wasn't off balance and that it was an unnatural thing to do. I think when you are sort of half jumping for a ball, any type, any there can be any small, you know, lack of balance when you're doing that. So I didn't agree with the interpretation that it was categorically an unnatural thing to do and that maybe a penalty would have sufficed.
Well, we should mention some of the other games. We've spoken about George Ford. Just a word on Sale, because played 5, won 4, lost 1. They lost in the final last year, but it seems like they're continuing to build on the success that they had. It strikes me that they're in a pretty good position, maybe in contrast to Bristol. Bristol are a fascinating one in a way with all the resources that they have. But you look at their last two seasons. In 2021-22, they finished 10th. Last year, they finished 9th. They won a couple of games to start this year, but have now lost a few. So they've lost 3 of the 5 that they've played so far. Barnsley, I feel like it's fair for Bristol fans to question what progress is being made, particularly when you factor in the resources that they have at their disposal.
The moment Bristol gave Pat Lamb a giant, I think it was a 5-year contract, was the moment Bristol seemed to lose their way. They don't seem a particularly happy team. They don't seem a team who know what they're trying to do at the moment. It's a horrible collapse because Bristol are one of the big city rugby clubs in the Premiership, and I think it's important that Bristol are strong. But they really are adrift at the moment. I mean, apart from a couple of lovely Callum Sheedy cross kicks, I haven't seen much to impress me. I think Pat Lamb is struggling at the moment to work out exactly what to do. Other teams, of course, are playing some quite progressive rugby as well. Now, when Bristol came up, they were almost on their own in playing this dashing, running rugby, maybe with Wasps a few years ago. Others are doing it now, and it seems to me that other teams, when they play with a bit of pace, Bristol find it quite hard to live with it. They seem defensively naive. They seem a little bit confused what they're trying to do at scrum half. I tend not to look at results in the first 5-6 weeks. And I know it's different when there's only 18 games before playoffs, but I try and see how teams are playing. I'm liking Northampton a lot for the progress they're making. And I'm disliking Bristol quite a lot for the regression in their game. If I was a fan of any club, I would be pleased to be Northampton and I would be worried to be Bristol.
It's interesting. I've seen quite a few fans for Bristol mention as well that they've felt the atmosphere at Ashton Gate feels flatter this year. Previously, the last 2 years, even though they weren't performing too well, I think it was still pretty good. But maybe the fans are getting a little concerned or tired with what they've seen.
Well, Ashton Gate's a big ground, isn't it?
Yeah.
This is the problem. If you've got a big ground and your team are playing badly and you don't fill it and it gets a little bit flat, it gets harder and harder. One of the few strengths of my old club, Bath, is no matter what problems they had for a long period, because their ground is quite a lot smaller than Ashton Gate, they'd always fill it up. And it didn't mean they'd always win, but it meant that brand Bath sustained itself. People wanted to go there, visiting fans and Bath fans. It was an occasion. There's a big danger when you've got a ground like Ashton Gate, if you're struggling and you're getting half full and you're not playing attractive rugby and you're losing, you're going to lose that fan base.
Well, the attendances were pretty strong. I need to check them this year, but they were pretty strong even the last couple of years when they weren't performing as well. But it's interesting. Do you want to say a final word on Sale? I'm conscious that last week we didn't mention too much either, Elgin. I know we've spoken about George Ford. Again, I'm impressed with Sale. I like where they are at the moment off the back of last season as well.
Absolutely. We've mentioned so many teams thus far, such as Northampton, who can look $1 million, but then just don't have that grunt, that forward power, that sort of toughness that's required to go all the way. And in Sale, they may not be as thrillingly exciting as some teams, but you do sense that they do just have that grit that Alex Anderson has instilled in them, with someone like George Ford who just knows how to get things done when the pressure's down. So you would expect to see them having a good season as they did last season.
Barnsley, as we say, you were at Leicester Harlequins. We've spoken about the fly halves. When I had to re-watch this game because I was at Portsmouth Charlton, as it turned out, actually, on Saturday. It was a return to football for me over the weekend. But so I had to re-watch Leicester Harlequins. And from some of what I'd seen, I was expecting it to be quite negative from Leicester's point of view. I know they've only won one game, but they were right in it, weren't they, for a lot of that game. Cronin had the knock on around 55 minutes close to the line, which was, you feel, a really key moment had they been able to cross and score there. What do you make of Leicester and where they are at the moment? Elgin, earlier you said that you feel like Leicester, you feel, should be okay and be able to maybe write some of those performances off that they'll be all right. Barnsley, what did you make of them?
I wouldn't be concerned if I was a Leicester fan. They're still solid up front and they are trying to play rugby. And if Pollard's such a class act, if he's fit, he'll get them playing. Quinn's had a really good day. And what Quinn's did, unusually, Leicester are very good at dominating that five-metre channel near the try line. This time, as you said, Cronin knocked on one or two little spills there, and Harlequins, when they got 5-6 metres out, they had a habit. Three of their five tries were taken close range. So I was impressed with Harlequins. I wasn't disappointed with Leicester. I just thought the better team won on the day. The only problem for Leicester is home advantage is so important psychologically. And having lost to Harlequins, they've got to get back on the bike now, because Northampton will come quite confident at the moment. And if Leicester lose next week and they're 1-6, then they've given up a lot of ground. But I do think that they are, at their best, one of the best teams in England. But they've got to get those wins quickly. And very briefly on Sale, we've talked about them not being flash and how they can grind out results. I'd also say, in their credit, they're getting some very good local talent. Yeah. You think of the likes of Roebuck and Carpenter. There's some good young backs coming through. And whilst at the moment the essence of Sale is control and forward power, they are developing all the time a really nice back three.
Yeah, Aaron Reid as well, scoring a
lot. Yeah, he's really exciting.
A lot of tries.
Super speed.
Yeah. Finally then, the one game we haven't mentioned, Newcastle against Saracens. Saracens resting more of their England players than we saw the week before, as we expected them to do. They went up and got a comfortable victory at Kingston Park, 50-12. I feel like on another episode we should try and delve deeper into Newcastle, because we don't have as much time now. But it's always a tricky one, isn't it? We know that they're probably not spending as much as other teams. Traditionally, it's been a tough place to go, but you feel like they aren't using similar resources at the moment. And Saracens, Elgin having lost their opening two of the season and it raising a few eyebrows, you do kind of feel like they are starting to shift through the gears to get themselves up into that top four.
Saracens are always going to be there at the top of the table end of the season. We've said so much already on this episode about how you can't read too much into everything thus far because we've had those three first weeks and now the post-World Cup weeks. But no matter how early in the season is, when you lose five games and ship 50 at home and lose by 38 points, there's no real way of sugarcoating that. So it isn't looking good for Newcastle. As you mentioned, there are so many off-the-field things that play into that. But on the field, it's not looking positive. And well, hopefully, over the course of the season, they will be able to muster some wins. And those are most likely to come on a, you know, sort of Friday night at Kingston Park down the road. So, yeah, it's not looking good thus far anyway.
When I talked about what's good and what's bad, I didn't mention Newcastle because they're taking such pastings at the moment, you think the kindest thing is to try and forget them. It worries me because we want a presence in the northeast. Sale have one in the northwest, where it's really hard to succeed because of the power of football and rugby league in Manchester. Newcastle at the moment should be taking all of Yorkshire and the northeast right up to the border, and it's not happening, and it's extremely worrying. And I think at some stage we have to get back to a serious sort of promotion relegation situation. And you don't want Newcastle at once being a team going down, because whilst the Premiership is about the clubs, and hopefully it'll be not just Premiership clubs, I hope it'll be a pro de deux, as we call them in France. I hope there'll be more than that. But this is a reminder that the RFU has to stay involved in the club game, because it can't afford to lose sort of 25% chunks of the land just because it doesn't have the finance or it can't get the players. It worries me a great deal, both on the field and off the field. Newcastle have done some outstanding things in the last few years without getting anywhere in the league, because they played very young players. They've developed quite a few England squad players, but it's bloody hard. There's only nine opponents now, and you know every one of those games is tough for Newcastle. And they can't keep taking 40, 50-point defeats, because that will demoralise young players. And if Newcastle become a team that starts signing old lags just to sort of shore up things, then what's the point?
Yeah, well, we'll park the Premiership chat there for now. Next week in the Premiership, it's the derby round. So every fixture is a derby. They all kind of make sense, don't they? Apart from the Sale Newcastle one, the old traditional Northern derby that I think they're probably trying to manufacture a little bit. But we'll be speaking about that on next week's episode. Up next on this week's episode, I caught up with our very own Jess Hayden to preview the start of the domestic game in the women's side.
Small details are big surfaces, tight corners are odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with five different spray patterns, so you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Ramesh Ranganathan, and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts, and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Jess, how are you?
I'm excited to be back. It's been a long time since I've been here because of the Men's Rugby World Cup obviously taking the headlines, but you've been keeping busy, haven't you?
I've been trying to. Will, Alex and Steve would probably say that maybe not. They saw me more out in France. But you're right, it has been ages, I feel like, since we've spoken to you. And it is actually one of the things that myself, Alan Dimmock and Elgin spoke about on last week's podcast, because we can mention it first, the WXV, which has finished, England the champions, great result for them, but it was almost a competition that perhaps in terms of the scheduling, it got a little bit lost amongst the Men's World Cup. Is that fair?
That's absolutely fair. And I mean, especially for England, they'll be feeling that because their new head coach, John Mitchell, couldn't join them until Japan were knocked out of the Men's World Cup. So it was a bit of a strange place to put it in the calendar, but it had to be there so that the domestic season can get started now. But I think in terms of the fan base, obviously, if a match is kicking off at 6 a.m. or 7 a.m. in UK time, you're not going to get a huge number of people watching it. And I was really disappointed with the crowd sizes in New Zealand. And another journalist who works out in New Zealand was saying that there was no marketing around it. And if you went to the World Cup that was also in New Zealand, you didn't then get an email to say, you were there last time, why don't you come along to this tournament as well? So I think there was definitely missed opportunities there in terms of building an audience. But in terms of the rugby, I think it was a really good tournament.
It was interesting looking at the results. So I know England winners, and generally when it comes to international rugby, England always expected to win or be there or thereabouts. But New Zealand, France are some of the other teams that you'd expected to be up there, not performing quite as well.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And I think France are in a really important transition phase now where some of their star players have retired and they're trying to kind of test out new blood and find their form again. New Zealand, they do tend to have massive dips in form after World Cups. And I mean, before the 21 World Cup, which was played in 2022, they lost on record-breaking losses on consecutive weekends against England the year before in the autumn. And then obviously they beat them in the final when it mattered. They do tend to build towards those big campaigns like a World Cup. If I was England, I wouldn't be feeling calm about that because they know what they're playing towards, and it's no promise that they won't be winning in 2025.
England know what's coming, don't they, later at that World
yeah,
Cup?
They yeah, they do.
I suppose as well with New Zealand, linking it back to the point you made about the fan base and the fans out there, again with the New Zealand public, it's maybe harder for them to engage with it if they know that it's a team that drop off a World Cup and then build again towards it, possibly, maybe,
I don't know. Really good point. Yeah, it could well be that as well.
Okay, well, let's move on to the domestic game in England. Premiership Women's Rugby, it's had another rebrand. I feel like the name changes every year, doesn't it?
I know. It's really frustrating to keep up with all the different name changes and all the different teams and the teams that we've lost and the teams that we've gained. There's been a lot of change, but I can't get my head around that it's PWR, Premiership Women's Rugby, and so we're calling it Power. And then because there's the Power Cup and the Power League, we're saying Power League. And to me, Power League is the place where you play five-a-side.
That's so true. I was thinking in my brain, I was like, Power League, I've heard that somewhere before. Is it darts? Is it something else? Yeah, it's five-a-side.
Yeah, you play five-a-side at Power League. I mean, my twin brother goes there all the time. So when I've been saying Power League, I'm like, no, this isn't a five-a-side down the, you know, down Power League. It's actually the highest level, the highest domestic league in the world for women's rugby. It's a bit of a weird one, but I quite like the power connotations.
I suppose it seems a little long-winded, even you having to try and explain it there, but we'll see if it catches on. Anyway, Premiership Women's Rugby, I think, is what I'm going to go for. Therefore, we know where we stand. And despite maybe some of the marketing issues that we've just run into with the name and how people are referring to it, massive, massive news ahead of the new season in terms of the broadcast deal.
That's right. So they've signed a multi-year deal with TNT Sports, which is also rebranded from BT Sports. So maybe that's how they bonded to show one match per round. That's across their TV and digital platforms. And they'll also show both semi-finals and the final, which will be on June 22nd next year. The important part of the deal for me is that clubs can also broadcast their home matches if TNT aren't showing them. So that's good, because I was thinking, if you're only seeing one game per round, then if you're a Trailfinders fan or a Loughborough Lightning fan, or basically one that's not really competing for the top four this season, you're unlikely to have your game shown on TNT. So it would be quite difficult, I think, to follow every team. I don't think it's going to encourage more people to go and watch the matches. I hope it does. I hope I'm wrong, and actually the gate figures this season are brilliant because of this. I do wish it was on free-to-air. I know that's what the Premiership Women's Rugby wanted as well, and the deal didn't come. And I think TNT is a good option, because you already have a very engaged rugby audience who have TNT because they follow the Premiership and I think
Champions Cup
and whatever else that they have on there.
Yeah.
So it's that's good, but I would hope it would be on free-to-air. And I believe that there's part of the deal allows for there to be more conversations in the future about whether the semi-final and the final is also on free-to-air as well as TNT.
Okay, interesting. That's so... I'm fascinated you said that, because my instinct when this all got announced and you see it over social media and the press release and everything about how this is such a brilliant moment for the women's game, and there's no doubt the investment in it, as you say, having a one game guaranteed every weekend on a TV channel that you can actually find, because maybe when it was on iPlayer it was a bit of an issue people being able to find it. But I wondered whether the game was at the point where that was more beneficial than simply having it available to everyone on free to air. And my worry was perhaps, and I was going to ask you, was any concern on the fact that it is behind a paywall?
Yeah, I do have concern about that, because as you say, anyone has been able to watch it. You might have to log into the Premier 15's website, as it was, or you might have to find it on iPlayer, which wasn't always easy, but it was free and you could do it and it was accessible. And sometimes the games were on YouTube, and that was really good, I think, for growing the audience. And it's a really good product. I present some of the matches on the Premiership Women's Rugby, and I have the best time, because it's an amazing atmosphere. The rugby's brilliant, and it's interesting rugby. You know, if you're just watching the internationals, and you don't really get a team that's cohesive all the time, do you? But at club level, it's a growing competition, and the highest level of domestic rugby, women's rugby in the world. So it is worth tuning into, and the season starts this Saturday.
Well, let's get on to the domestic season, the new season this weekend then. Bristol against Sale Sharks kick things off at 12:30 on Saturday. Then at 2:30, it's Saracens, Loughborough Lightning, and then Ealing Trailfinders against Harlequins at 3. And then the Sunday game, Leicester Tigers against Exeter Chiefs. Gloucester Hartbury get a bye week. They have the awkward, uneven number of teams, of course, because Worcester Warriors women recently declared that they wouldn't be able to take part in the league.
Yeah, and that was a really disappointing decision, I have to say, because the transfer window was done. You know, everyone had their transfers. Worcester believed, the players believed, that they'd be playing this season. And then a couple of weeks before it starts, the Worcester owners suddenly realise that they cannot fund the team for the following year. And you just think, like, where was the planning? Where was the research? How has this decision come now? It's the worst possible time for all the players. It's a really, really bad business, in my opinion. But it has also meant, it does mean that the league is a bit lopsided. We only have 9 teams, and there's huge changes this year, because Worcester have gone, so have DMP Sharks and Wasps, obviously suffering the same collapse that the men's team did there. But we're gaining Trailfinders women, who are Ealing Trailfinders, but they're going by Trailfinders women, and Leicester Tigers, which is exciting. We don't know if they're going to follow the same kind of playing style as the men, but if they do, it would be brilliant for the audiences. But yeah, it's really exciting new season, fresh blood in the league, and lots of exciting international transfers in, like Beatrice Rigoni, who's joining Sale Sharks. That's amazing. She's an Italian player who is electric on the field, and also lots of really interesting signings between teams. It just means that this season is going to be so interesting.
I was going to mention that, because many people know they can go and watch the Women's Premiership Rugby, and I had to check the name there, see, for a minute. I was going to say Premier 15s, whatever, but they know that they can watch the Red Roses in the league. But actually, there's loads of other internationals as well, isn't there? When I was looking through it, a lot of the American team play. You've obviously got Ireland, Welsh, Scottish contingent as well. There's a lot of quality spread throughout the league.
Oh, there really is. And it's interesting with Wales that almost every player, I think there's only one player who's contracted with Wales who doesn't play in the Premiership Women's Rugby. A little bit awkward now with the Worcester going down because they had lots of Wales players. They're kind of moving around trying to find their places now. But you're right, there's so much international talent. And that just shows how this league is absolutely the best in the world.
Okay, what I thought we could do, Jess, is let's run through each team and I'm going to say a tiny synopsis from my point of view, very, very brief. And then you as the expert, I thought, could expand upon it. Does that work for you?
Yeah,
should we give
fine.
It a go?
Yeah.
Fine. So I was going to start off with Bristol Bears. Mm-hmm. Semi-finalists the last few years. Is it now the challenge for Dave Ward and that team for them to go the step further to get to the final?
I think they've got to. That has to be their ambition this season. They've lost semi-finals in the last two seasons. And this is a really good team. And the interesting thing about Bristol is they have the best resources in the league in terms of their facilities. They're very much a one-club mentality place. The facilities, the gym, everything is incredible. They get nutritionist support. And very much, it's almost like an international setup at club level. So lots of the players here at Bristol who go to England tell me that Bristol camp is better than England camp, so they have a lot of support. Dave Ward is a brilliant coach. He's so good. He picks up, I mean, his front row, he has like a world-class front row, and I think that's going to be a really interesting thing this season, is seeing how the pack comes together.
Interesting. So Exeter, losing finalists the last 2 years. Again, I suppose similar questions to what I just asked on Bristol, but the challenge for them now is to win it all.
They have to. That has to be their ambition, doesn't it? Because you can't get into the final. And
nowhere else to go, is there?
Yeah, there is nowhere else to go. And Susie Appleby is so she's so ambitious. And a fellow journalist, Matt Merritt, called Exeter the bridesmaids of the Premier 15s or now the Premiership Women's Rugby, because they get there but they don't quite win it, and they really need to step up. They've had two excellent seasons the last two seasons. They've performed so well. I think that it's important to say that loss of Kate Zachary is really important, because she pulled together that team so well, but they still have some really good players there. And as I said, it's still kind of the hub for international talent. So I'd like to see them really push for that top four. And you know, they have to win the final if that has to be their ambition.
On to Harlequins aside, who've dropped off maybe from their previous heights. They used to always be right up there, but recently that hasn't been the case.
Yeah, you're right. I would agree that I think they've fallen away in the last two seasons. And part of that for me was losing Karen Finlay, who was their head coach, who the most phenomenal woman. She's also like one of the most senior women in the Met Police, but also was coaching Harlequins women. Amazing coach. And I think that's been a real loss. And since Karen left, I think there has been a drop off in performance. So I actually think this could be their worst season. Yeah, I have to say it. I can't see them being anywhere close to the top four.
It's going to be a tough one for them. What about Gloucester Hartbury then? As we say, they've got a bye on the opening week, but defending champions, they got the quality to go back to back.
Gloucester Hartbury is easily the most fun team to watch. Sean Lynn, their head coach, is just hilarious. He loves rugby, but he loves fun and family more. And the atmosphere that he's built at Gloucester Hartbury is incredible. It's so fun, relaxed, and they just take every game as it comes. And I think Mo Hunt, who's co-captain there, epitomises that team's philosophy, which is have fun with it, work really hard, put all the effort in, but have a smile on your face while you're doing it. And they just stormed past everyone really at the last season, and it was phenomenal to watch. So their back line is incredible and so talented. And yeah, you could take your pick of who to watch, but of course Mo Hunt is the one that everyone's
favourite.
That's
the name everyone knows, yeah. Absolutely. Let's rattle through the other teams. Leicester Tigers, really interesting. So they won the championship last season. They've come up into the top division. I guess the question is it, can they step up? Is it about consolidation and getting themselves a part of that top division?
It's interesting. It's almost like there's a pathway, isn't there? You know?
Yeah, who would have thought?
When do we see that? So Vicky McQueen is the head coach at Leicester Tigers, and they do have a very strong core group who've worked together before in the championship. They've brought in a couple of people. I'd say Emmy Cocaine is the biggest name there. I don't know if this is their season yet. I think they're going to need to make some more signings, make sure that they've got the right investment and facilities, etc. When you're a new team and you're doing that huge step up from Championship One to the Premiership, that's going to be difficult. So I'll give them a couple of years to bed in. I haven't seen anything that I'm super impressed by in terms of their signing, whereas with Trailfinders, they've made big enough signings where I think they have a really good chance.
Well, I tell you what, let's get on to Trailfinders then, because they are fascinating. Abby Dow, I think, was the first player they announced as signing. What a signing that is. Giselle Mather, head coach. I mean, there's a lot of quality within that setup, isn't there?
Yeah, I am so excited to watch them this season because, as you say, Giselle Mather, former Red Rose, for those who don't know, she was also one of the first women to get the top level of coaching qualification in the UK. She's coached the likes of Anthony Watson at London Irish, and she's an incredible coach. And she's now been in the women's game for a long time. I mean, obviously, Red Rose. She coached Wasp, and her talent is finding players like Maud Muir, who's a Red Rose front rower, and making them the absolute best version of themselves. And Maud is the most versatile player, and she credits that to Giselle because Giselle made her play in the second row so that she could get some of those skills that she would need to be a more all-round player. I think she was robbed of the England job. I don't know if she applied, but I would really hope that
I think Steve was very hot on Giselle. I believe I'm correct in saying that Steve was backing Giselle for the Red Rose job.
Yeah, I was backing her too. I really wanted her to get it. I mean, obviously, because she just signed at Trailfinders, I don't know if that was her ambition, but I hope that we see her one day in that hot seat. I just think, it's going to be a huge season for them. And genuinely, maybe not top four in their first season, but I wouldn't put it past them. Giselle knows what she's doing. She knows this league.
It seems like she's the perfect person to be in place for all the challenges they'll face. But also it is about how can they bring it all together with so many new players and in the league, etc. But it's going to be fascinating to watch. Loughborough Lightning, they're an interesting one, aren't they? The two sides that finished below them in the league last year are no longer a part of it. So kind of where are they and what's their aspiration?
They're another one like Harlequins, who were maybe a few seasons ago going for the top four, finishing top four. But now the form has fallen away a bit, and they've lost Sarah Hunter. Emily Scarrett's been out with injury as well. So that their star power is kind of not there at the moment. I would predict they'll finish bottom this season.
Okay, interesting. Final two teams then, Sale Sharks and Saracens, contrasting teams there as well, aren't they? I suppose from a Saracens point of view, it's interesting because they have been the dominant force in the women's game, but they didn't make the final last year. So for them, is it kind of about reasserting their dominance? And then from a Sale point of view, they've been slowly trying to build, haven't they? But they're still towards the bottom end of the table.
Yeah, they are quite opposite. I would say with Saracens, they're always the team with a chip on their shoulder. And this season, for the first time, they have an actual fair chance to say they are the underdogs, because they didn't do as well as they needed to. They didn't get into the final. It was their first time missing the final. Alex Osterbury, the head coach there, is a very fierce character. And I think he demands excellence, and the environment is so intense and the pressure's there. I don't know how great that's working because I think
it's a fine balance, that kind of approach, isn't it?
The temperature is very high in the Saracens women, and that can spill over. And I think that for Saracens to really go one further this season, or would be, well, they have to get to the final and then they would hope to win it as well, I'm sure. I think they need to work on the culture of the team. I think that's really important. But yeah, I think top four.
Mm-hmm. Sale.
Let's see. Sale, it's a tough one. So they it's a team that doesn't have much funding. They only just stayed in the Premiership by the skin of their teeth. Rachel Taylor, who's a former Wales player, she's leading the charge there. No real huge star talent apart from Beatrix Rigoni, who is like their one star signing, who is fantastic. She's hilarious. She's so funny to watch. She wears sunglasses. She looks like an old Italian football manager, how she turns up to all the matches. She's absolutely hilarious. Love her. Huge personality hire, but also she just has tricks up her sleeve aplenty and is always finding the space and really playing what's on. And I think that if she can unlock the Sale Sharks backs, and that will be really good for them. Don't know if she's enough on her own to lift Sale out of that bottom half of the league. But I do genuinely think, and I'm not just saying this, I'm not a PR person at all. But this is the most exciting season yet. New talent, new faces, different signings, people moving around all over the place. It's going to be really exciting. So, lots to play for.
Best league in the world. That's what you said earlier. Make sure people tune in. Jess, good to see you.
And you, yeah.
Final thing.
Yep.
Christmas on the way. What on earth should people be buying? What rugby book is out?
So this is the only reason I'm back, you know. I'm joking.
Jess has written a book.
Thank you for the really subtle plug there. So I've written a book about the Red Roses. It's called The Red Roses. After 70,000 words of writing, I've run out of creativity for a name. So it's just called The Red Roses. It's about the current squad and their failure to win the World Cup in 2022, but looking forward to 2025 as well when they host the World Cup and they obviously want to win it back. There's a bit about the history as well and looking at the real roots of women's rugby in England. But it's very much kind of looking behind the scenes, tapping into the culture, where things have gone really wrong in the culture, the Red Roses, what needs to improve before 2025. And also, you know, I spoke to every single member of the squad and the coaching setup and the background staff. So from the nutritionist to the kit man, everyone was spoken to. So it's a very well-rounded picture of this high-performance environment of the most best funded women's rugby team in the world. So really excited. It's pre-orders are open now on Amazon and it's published on the 7th of March next year.
Oh, good on you. The Red Roses.
The Red Roses,
Red Roses, make sure. Good to see you, Jess. Appreciate you coming in.
Yeah, and you. Thank you.
Coming up next, it's back to Stuart and Elgin. We're going to finish this episode by naming our God or Goddess of the Week. So great to catch up with Jess, finishing the pod off back here with Elgin and Barnsley, God or Goddess of the Week. I can kick us off here, actually, this week. I was going to nominate Henry Arundel, fresh from a World Cup with England, which was a mixed bag, a heap of tries against Chile. Other than that, a bit of a fringe player in that squad. A hat-trick on debut for Racing 92. I think a lot of England fans will be watching with interest how he gets on over there under the tutelage of Stuart Lancaster. So Henry Arundel gets my nod.
It's interesting to look over in France to see how the England players are doing. Obviously, Arundel will take all the headlines for that hat-trick, but you had Zach Henry scoring 21 points for Stade Francais at fly half. He was one of the three players, along with Arundel, nominated online for Player of the Week. You got Joe Simmons, Poe at fly half. He kicked a few points in their victory, and Sam Simmons down at Montpellier. Montpellier lost, but he scored a try from number eight, and obviously he's filling the footsteps of Zach Mercer, who obviously did so well at Montpellier at number eight. So it'll be interesting keeping tabs on those high-profile England players that are out in France this season.
Yeah, absolutely. Elgin, God or Goddess?
For me, I'm looking over to France again. I'm looking over to Alain Esteve, who died this week. He's in his 70s. He was... The 1970s rugby was completely Wild West, and all sorts of skullduggery went on. And in the France and the great Béziers team of the 70s, Esteve was the enforcer nonpareil. He was more than 2 meters tall. You know, he would have looked massive now, let alone in the 70s. And he's got such an interesting backstory. He had such a troubled background, and I think that probably informed some of his enforcer ways on the field as part of this mighty Béziers team. And obviously it was sad to see that he died this week. And I've got a lot of love for the French players of yesteryear, and especially that great Béziers team, having been to the grounds to watch games in recent years. Obviously they're not the great team they were back then, but I'm going for Esteve just for the memories of that long ago era of the 70s in French rugby.
Okay, like it. I don't think anyone would have been predicting that one. That might be the most Elgin Alderman choice for God of the Week ever. I quite like the selection. Barnsley, what direction are you heading in?
Can I have a little devil as well?
Of course.
My devil is Finn Russell for that shushing of the shed. All in great spirit. Good for the game. Good for Bath. And the shed will love it. Shed love a villain too. So all round, he's my devil of the week. My God of the week, I've got to go with you. I spent 2 months scratching my head thinking, come on, England, do something to be positive. And Arundel, when they did pick him, he got 5 tries against Chile. He didn't get a pass in 55 minutes. I know that he's got to hunt for the ball himself, but quite clearly England didn't have a clue how to make him comfortable. On his debut against Toulon, of all teams, he gets a hat trick. One of them is a cracking finish. Two of them are superbly taken, reasonable range tries. Henry Arundel has to be the God of the Week and the England management should be on their knees begging forgiveness for not using him.
Well, that'll be a conversation that I know we will be having later on down the line when it comes to Six Nations squads and whatnot. Barnsley, appreciate your time. Great to have you on.
It's my pleasure, Alfie. Thank you.
And likewise, Elgin, good to see you again.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks very much for listening. This has been The Ruck from The Times and The Sunday Times. Make sure you follow and subscribe wherever you get your podcast from. And also, if you've enjoyed it enough, then leave us a review as well. We'd massively appreciate that one. But we will be back next week.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.